Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
Pat Smullen, thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Not at all, Joe. A pleasure.
Just looking at your house already, you can see you have an amazing life. It's the first time I've been in a bathroom where there's a handwritten note from Bono.
Yeah, no, there's a bit of a story to that, actually. I rode a great horse called Vinnie Roll, and it was owned by the film director, Jim Sheridan. Yeah. And we were at the ARC meeting, and they were worried about the ground for him, and he was running in the ARC, and he ran well. He finished fifth, but Bono sent down a handwritten sort of a bit of a poem, really. Yeah. And so just saying that, you know, not to worry about the ground and so forth. But yeah, it's a treasured piece of what would you call archive to have. Yeah. And might be worth money in time.
I'm sure it is. I'm sure we're money now. I couldn't make out the handwriting, actually. Ground. Was that what that was?
Yeah, right. Yeah. No,
terrible handwriting, Bono.
It took a lot of studying to understand it, but yeah, it was nice of him actually on the day, and you know, it was to take the time. It was actually written on the back of a sheet that the race card, that's actually the race card.
Yeah.
And so yeah, no, we got it framed up.
Dead right. You can see, I mean, people might see a few photos behind us, but they're all over the house. Like, it just struck me, geez, what a full, rich life, you know, a lot of great days you've had down the years.
I've been very fortunate, you know, to have ridden a lot of good horses and had great days and ridden for great people. And, you know, as I said, very fortunate and enjoyed every minute of it. And so it's, yeah, there are some treasured trophies there that, you know, they were hard earned and very proud of having them, to be honest.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're in the midst of a battle, really, and an unbelievable journey. Take us back to February, March 2018.
Yeah, it was, you know, I was feeling a lot of pain in my back. And, you know, I thought it was a pulled muscle, and I was getting a lot of extensive physiotherapy. And but it wasn't going away, and I was doing a lot of exercise and coming into the season, and it was really bothering me. And then, not to be rude, but the telltale sign that I knew there was something quite not right was my urine went a very bad colour, and I went straight to the GP, and initially we thought it was gallstones, and but within 48 hours we knew what we were facing. And
that quick, was it?
Yeah. No, we had I went to the Beacon and then ended up in Vincent's private, which was very much a stroke of luck, to be honest with you, that my GP took the decision to try and get me in there to access the best people for the condition that I had. And that was a very, very important move, in my opinion, because they have been nothing short of unbelievable. And so far, things have gone well. So that's all we can hope for.
And was this Adrian McGoldrick that you went to initially?
Yes, Adrian McGoldrick is an amazing man. I mean, I've been quoted several times saying that, you know, if you're lucky in your lifetime to meet some amazing people, and he is one of them. And you know, he went above and beyond the call of duty with me, and has done throughout the last 14-15 months. And you know, without his support, I wouldn't have got to this far as well as I'm doing. So you know, how can you say, like, he's just an amazing man. And
I hear that from everyone,
and I'm very, very fortunate that he's my GP and a very close friend.
When you're heading up on the 26th to get the diagnosis, you and your wife Frances, who we met a few moments ago, in your head are you thinking this isn't good, or were you still hopeful at that stage?
No, after the tests that were done in the Beacon, I knew we were in trouble. I knew that this was serious, you know. But you never want to let yourself think that it's cancer. I mean, I was hoping it was gallstones. I was hoping it might be something else, and but I knew it was that it was serious. Yeah. And you know what, you can read body language of people.
Right.
And you can read the body language of people. And
so was it a doctor that you knew who told you?
No. The doctor I never saw before. He did all the, he read obviously the scans that were done and all the various tests, and he told us that that there was a tumor on the pancreas. That's what it looked like, and you know, that was obviously devastating. And
I remember hearing a while back, when I can't even remember where I heard it, it doesn't actually matter, but I remember a doctor who often delivers bad news was saying he advises patients to almost turn on their phone and hit record as soon as something like the word cancer is thrown in at a patient, because you just go into almost a sense of shock. You're not taking in anything after that word, yeah. And you almost need the recording to tell you what's going on. I presume you can relate to that.
I had my wife there, so yeah. She was recording everything in her own mind. Yeah. I agree with you 100% that was very much the case, because obviously shock. But to be honest with you, the word cancer, and myself and the people around me, never said the word cancer for quite a long time. It was a tumour on my pancreas. Right. And that's what I said. That's what the medical people said. And, you know, because at the end of the day, you know, the word is just, as I said before in an interview, it's frightening, you know. Mm. And I think you're trying to prevent from saying, and it took me a long time to actually say that I've got cancer. And, you know, if people ask me how, you know, they found a tumour on my pancreas. And that's the way I sort of dealt with it. And right. Not that I was hiding from it or anything, but, you know, I knew what it was, of course. And
the enormity of it, almost.
Of course, yeah, yeah. I knew what. But I, thankfully, my mindset was very much within 24 hours that, you know, it is what it is. Mm. And we have to get stuck in and fight it.
It's such a sporting attitude to it, isn't it?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, the way I looked at it, and I spoke to the couple of my brothers that were up in the bedroom and in the hospital, and it's like, as I said to them, it's either a case of two things. You either get up and fight it, or you lie down and give up. Mm. And I sure as hell wasn't lying down and giving up.
And from that moment on the 26th, do you drive home, or is it straight into treatment in hospital? Or
no, I was there for a couple of days, and... they did more tests. There was a biopsy done. You know, so all that was put in place. And what was happening actually was that there was the tumour was putting pressure on my bile duct, and I was getting jaundiced, and I was starting to poison me. Right. So that had to be addressed immediately. So I had a procedure to relieve the pressure from the bile duct, and from that I actually started to feel well again for the minute I got that done.
Yeah, and let me out of here.
Yeah. But and then it was a couple of weeks or maybe 6 weeks before they started the treatment. So okay. I was home for a while and then got stuck into the treatment.
Do you go and see a counsellor? Do you talk to anyone? How do you almost absorb the shock of it from being a 41-year-old as healthy as you can be?
Yeah, no, I didn't go to see a counsellor, but I was very, very fortunate in that there was a nurse in Vincent's private, Dee is her name, and she came in on the first night after my diagnosis, the first night I was in Vincent's private right. hospital.
Right.
And everyone had left and I was in the bedroom, and she came in and sat down on the end of the bed, and she gave me a proper talking to in a very, very positive way, and that, you know, this is something that we are going to fight, not me, we, and
you're not alone,
and that you know, you have to think positively, and you have to just get stuck in, and that was the most important conversation of my life, and that turned my mind around. And and from that day to this, I've been very, very, oh, don't get me wrong, I have my odd bad day, but in general I've had a very positive outlook on it, and but that's, I have to credit her for that.
Wow. It's amazing, like a pep talk almost.
Unbelievable, yeah. And but I distinctly remember her saying, we, you know, that has stuck in my head, for, you know, that we are going to fight it, and we are going to get through this. And and that was just as I said, it was a turning point for me. I guess from that day, if these people that don't know me are prepared to get stuck in and try and make you better, sure as hell I have to put my bit in as well, you know. So thankfully, as I said, to today, things have gone very, very well, and it's because it's a very serious diagnosis, you know, pancreatic cancer. I didn't look up anything. I didn't Google.
It was my next question.
Yeah,
it's my next question.
I didn't Google anything. She told me not to Google anything, Dee, and I didn't, and never have. And because I believe the statistics are not good. I just got stuck in, and as I said, so far so good, and we're nearing, hopefully I think we're finished the treatment, and we just have to take every day as it comes, and hopefully we can continue to keep getting better.
Have you ever seen Dee again?
Oh, yeah. She calls in to see me when I'm having my treatment, and she's on the fifth floor, and you're getting treatment on the third floor. And, you know, we've met, and I will always keep in touch with her. And something we only spoke about recently is that, and I have to do it myself, is that we have to do something to raise awareness of pancreatic cancer. And that's something, that's a project that's going to get going in my mind in the coming months when I, please God, when I am back in good form and well. And that's something that we have to do.
Isn't it amazing? You know, so I'm in an industry which gets very excited about what sports people do and put them up on a pedestal. And the reality is it's all just fluff. Ultimately, it's entertainment. Not for you, it's a bit more than entertainment. But then you see someone like, say, Dee, who is probably going around giving that pep talk to lots of people, doing something so important on a daily basis and like completely taken for granted by society.
But I was one of those people. I thought my job was very important, and I thought I was a very important person. And I thought...
Dee doesn't have a handwritten note from Bono on her toilet.
Well, she deserves one, but... you know, as I said, you go around in a bubble, don't you? You think that you're very important in the job that you're doing, and it is. It's a big business. Don't get me wrong, but when something like this happens, and I was a very selfish person, you know, towards my wife and the kids, and to me, it was all about riding horses and winning races and delivering on the day for the owners and the trainers, and I was to be honest a little bit obsessed with it, and. But by God, does not open your eyes to what is important in life, and you know what the surgeons do, what the oncologists do, what the nurses do. I mean, they're heroes. I mean, they're, you know, what, as you say, what sporting people do is very, very entertaining for a lot of people, and a lot of people get enjoyment out of it. But when your back is against the wall and it's a serious situation, you know, these people don't get half enough recognition. But they don't want recognition. They're just doing their job, which is amazing. Whereas, you know, you get a little bit complacent yourself and think that it's great, all this, you know, plaudits you get for winning races. And But no, it opened my eyes to what life is actually about.
And had your general health been pretty good? Was this a complete shock?
Absolutely, out of the blue. Uh-huh. I was and thankfully, they have... On numerous occasions, the nurses and the surgeon said my physical health in every other way, apart from what I had, and my fitness was a huge advantage in me getting through what I had to go through. And, you know, there was no excess weight on me. I was as fit as you could possibly be. And I think one of the nurses said I was like... when they were taking my blood pressure and stuff, it was like a 19-year-old, which gave me great pleasure. But,
text Dermot well straight away.
But I did that. But as regards my, thankfully I was never in hospital.
Yeah.
Never broke a bone. I was very, very fortunate up until now.
And Pat, what's it been like spending time in hospital for someone who's never actually experienced that world very much?
Only for the people that are there. I mean, I was in a, don't get me wrong, I was very fortunate to be in one of the best hospitals probably in the world. Definitely, you know, I cannot see, you know, I had a lot of people offer me to bring me around the world to try and get the best treatment. And Adrian McGoldrick was adamant that this was the place to be, and I cannot have it that there's any better around the world. So they made it easy for me in that way. They're just amazing people, as I said, the nurses. And but I was so ill after the surgery that, you know, one day I went into the next, and I was in there for 6 weeks.
Was this October when you had the surgery?
October. So, okay. Like, really, until then, I was up and down just getting treatment every fortnight. So
was that chemo? Or?
Chemotherapy, and a very extensive chemotherapy. Thankfully, I was, again, my fitness and my youth on my side allowed me to take the strongest dose of chemotherapy that they can get given, and it was very, very it was very, very important, because I would not have had the surgery if the treatment didn't work.
So as I understand it, you're diagnosed in March 26th, and then you don't have surgery until October, say. Is that intervening few months, that's about having the chemo and trying to shrink the tumor to have the surgery?
Exactly, 100%. Obviously the first question I asked was, why can't we have the surgery immediately, you know? And the surgeon, He Justin Gagan, an amazing man, he said to me, you know, look, it's in a very tricky place, and it's very quite close to a main artery, and so while I was positive throughout the treatment, and you had to keep positive, but always in the back of your mind, you're like, this has to work for me to have surgery.
So if they had said, look, the tumour's not getting any smaller with the chemo, then we can't have surgery.
I was in big trouble.
They're scary drives back from chemo where you're thinking this bloody better work.
But I sat where you're sitting every day watching racing throughout the treatment, and I'd say to Francis, I feel something here. I feel like it's working. I said, I feel like it's, you know, I can feel activity there.
Right. Do you think you actually could?
Yeah, I've no doubt. And the one thing I've come to learn is that the mind, unfortunately, can be a very, very fragile thing, but it can be a very strong thing too. Mm. But I was envisaging this tumour shrinking and shrinking.
It's almost like visualisation of a race almost, isn't it?
Yeah, and that was very much the case. Whether that sounds crazy or not, I don't know. But I could feel that it was, and thankfully it did anyway, I was right or wrong, or in, you know. But I think you have to have that mindset to try and get through it more than anything else. Because if you start to think the alternative.
Yeah. And did you, so a question I wanted to ask you was about almost facing mortality in a real way, because people my age, people your age, we think about our mortality in the abstract.
Yeah.
Yeah, look, that will happen one day eventually.
Yeah.
So you're at points, I would presume, maybe on just the down days, I don't know, but you're thinking about your mortality in a real way. You know, you're thinking about leaving behind a family, you're thinking about this whole thing being over. Does that teach anything about yourself, about life? Does that bring any sudden realization?
You know, I actually never thought I was going to die. I just didn't allow myself, and whether that was a foolish thing or, you know, and to this day I don't, you know, of course it's going to happen to us all at some stage, but right now I'm not ready, and I never allowed myself to think that. But of course on occasion you get down and you know, but I'll be honest with you, it'll be for about half an hour, and then I give myself a kick up the backside and just say, come on, get on with it. And then when you see your kids and a great wife and I have a lot to live for, and, you know, it's how I dealt with it anyway. And I think that stood me in good stead, because I just didn't allow negativity into, and there's some people that are very well-meaning, but there was some people that just, you know, I didn't like meeting, in that they were, how are things, and their expression, well, they meant good, that their whole demeanour was, and their expression was that, oh, this is, you know, it's terrible.
You're on the way out.
Yeah, that's exactly, yeah. So, you know, I actually tried to distance myself from a few people like that, and I just wanted all positivity around me, and I think that was very, very important. I think it's very, very important, and if there's one bit of advice I'd give to anybody that's going through the same thing, is to just keep positive, because, you know, there's so much happening on a daily basis as regards, you know, testing and, you know, research, and there's everything's happening. And so I kept telling myself, you know, this, they'll come up with something, and this treatment will work. And, you know, so that was very important to me. And to be honest with you, that's how I dealt with it.
Right. Interesting. Listening to you, it's not like it's a happy clappy positivity, and it's most certainly not a negativity, as you've explained. It's almost like a slightly aggressive, like Dee's pep talk. Let's get up here and do this. It's a fight.
Very much so. Like, I mean, you know, you have to remember, I've been riding racehorses since I was 15. I left school very early, you know, and, you know, with no education behind me. And I've, like, from 15, I said, this has to work. My career has to work. If it doesn't, where do I turn? You know what I mean? And like, against my parents' wishes, you know, I was so determined to make it as a jockey. And so I think that sort of mindset came into play again with this. And it got me to be somewhat of a successful jockey. And I think it's got me through this as well.
And how did the surgery go when you eventually got around to having it?
The surgery went extremely well. Right. And they were very, very positive about it afterwards, that it went so well. And but then, unfortunately, about 3 weeks later, it's what's called stomach emptying. Like, you have to remember, I had what's called a Whipple's procedure, which from what I gather, pretty much everything comes out and goes back in again, if you know what I mean.
Right.
For, yeah. Okay. And so the want of a better expression, as I was taught, I'm plumbed differently than I was before. So it all has to start working, and what they call stomach emptying. And that was the toughest time I've had ever in my life, was going through those couple of weeks, because it wasn't happening. And so eventually found out that there was a blockage.
Okay.
And so I had to have a second surgery. And when I went in for the second surgery, which they thought was going to just release that blockage, I found that I had twisted my gut a little bit as well when everything was settling down. So that had to be addressed as well. So I ended up having a major, major surgery followed by a major surgery. And after the first surgery, I was very positive. Like, I came out of the anaesthetic at too good. Everyone was saying, like, I was bouncing. I was, right. But then after
probably
the
second,
yeah, on a high, yeah. But and I was really good, you know. But then as the stomach emptying didn't happen, and you know, I was getting me, wearing me down, and then having the second surgery, you know, it wiped me out completely, to be honest with you. And it took me a long time to recover from that.
Right. So that's towards the back end of last year. Where are you now? What's happened since the second surgery?
So I had the surgery and the two surgeries, and eventually, thank God, I got out in time for come home for Christmas. And
right. What was that like?
Oh, brilliant. I was like, you know, I must admit, as it was getting closer, I was like, I can't be in here for Christmas. I just, you know, and thankfully the last week I was starting to feel well, and I was walking around the corridors in the ward, and
yeah.
And the funniest thing ever, I remarked to myself walking by, well, there's a lot of sick people in here.
And, I'd hate to be one of them,
yeah,
says Pat's.
Yeah. And so, you know, but then I wanted, I need to get out of here. I need to get out of here. And thankfully, I, you know, a week later, I was discharged and home for Christmas. And, you know, from the minute I got home, then everything just started to go the right way, I suppose, back in your own environment, and started to thrive again. And so that all went until after Christmas into the new year.
I'd say Santa arriving on Christmas morning never felt so good.
Never felt so good. It was just, it was just amazing. You know, to see the kids, and yeah, that was special.
I can imagine. I guess probably almost too emotive to even think about or talk about, because you just,
yeah, exactly.
And how can you protect them from this? Like, it strikes me, a year, when you think back to being a kid, and you've three children, a year and a half is a long time when you're a kid.
Yeah.
And you don't want them worrying for a year.
Yeah, no, you know, they dealt with it well, but you could see, though, in their minds, they were thinking, and Hannah's 16, so I'm sure she Googled everything, you know, and so that was difficult on her. And the other two are a bit younger, and, you know, I think a lot of it went over their heads. I think a lot, which was good, yeah. You know, a lot of it went over their heads. So, you know, I was just... I must admit, though, you know, when I went through the treatment before surgery and after surgery, and when I got home, you know, I always got up every morning and got out and walked around. You know, I didn't want the kids thinking, oh, he's sick up in bed.
Okay.
And then when they're gone to school, I might crash on the couch then, and, you know, you'd be exhausted. But, yeah. But I didn't want them to, I just made myself get up every morning and come down. And I think that was very helpful for them.
Yeah, no doubt. The racing community, like, there's an outpouring, an amazing thing. Can you talk to us a bit about that?
Unbelievable is the only word. I mean, but myself and Francis were overwhelmed by the support of people, my employers, and then people from all around the world, the heads of big racing organizations got in touch if I needed anything, and you know, it was. It was humbling, to be honest with you,
right.
Because, you know, I like to think I conducted myself well throughout my career, and, you know, treated people with respect. And, you know, I think that came back to me and when we were ill, because, you know, if I needed, I didn't need anything. All I needed was the treatment that I was getting and the support of people. That's all I needed, and I was getting that. But if I needed anything financially, medical wise, there were people there prepared to provide that for me in whatever possible way. So that was...
It's a bit of a burden, I'd say, off. You know, other people don't have that
yeah,
same...
Yeah, it was, as I said, nothing short of overwhelming, because, you know, I'm sure, you know, there's other people that would be in the same need of that. But thankfully, we were in a position that But you know, as I said, I didn't need anything from anybody, only their support and getting the treatment that I got in the hospital that I was in. That's all I needed, but it was as I said, it was quite overwhelming, really.
And on the treatment, you know, I didn't need to Google pancreatic cancer to just know it's one of the bad ones.
Yeah.
Has treatment of that changed in recent years? Is there a more positive outlook than there might have been 10, 15 years
ago? Oh, yeah, very much so. They've moved on a lot. It's, you know, the treatment now and the chemotherapy that they're using is very effective. And as I said, it needed to be for me to have surgery. So, yeah, things are moving on. But as all, with not just pancreatic cancer, but with every... As you know, cancer that's there, we need to keep working and trying to.
Sure.
And it's only now you realise the importance of research and people funding research and so with every day it's moving forward. So there, you know, the percentages are increasing, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
With every day. So and you have to keep telling yourself that.
No doubt. And what's the prognosis now, or is it a wait and see situation?
It's very much a wait and see situation. I mean, we had a meeting with the oncologist. They're very happy with how things are at the moment. The scan is good. My bloods are good. They're quite happy that I'm finished the treatment now.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, but unfortunately, it's something that I have to live with. You know, the chances of a return are probably a little bit greater than most cancers. So I have to keep myself checked regularly. And you know, but that said, I have to try and get on with my life as well, you know. So while we'll be very vigilant in checking and taking care of myself, I have to live my life as well. So that's the plan to go forward now and try and just live every day as it comes.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. So that's treatment done
at the moment. Yeah, look, as I said, I hate to start taking, you know, it's finished now. Yeah. And
you don't want to jinx words all clear or anything.
Yeah, no. Yeah. But I this thing of all clear, I don't think you'll ever be in my mind, because you know you'll always be worrying that it'll return. So that's always going to be in the back of my mind, and as I said, that's something I have to live with. But equally, I can't let it rule my life, and so now I just hope to push forward and try and get some normality back into all our lives.
So when the worry comes through of a morning, geez, I hope it's not back any day soon, how do you kick that thought curb? Just that mental strength you're talking about.
Well, I have to just keep calling on that. And how long that lasts, I don't know, Joe. But that's very much the way I'm approaching it at the moment. Is that, you know, we're on top of it.
Great.
That's the way to look at it. And now, you know, they're happy for me to think that I can go and live my life. So that's where we're at. But as I said, we have to be very careful and keep ourselves checked regularly.
Geez, that's some year of your life. It must be a bit surreal this has happened to you.
Unbelievable, yeah. You know, you know, I must admit, only now, I think, you know, I have a little bit of broken sleep at the moment, because I think I'm only really starting to take it all in.
Oh, it's like you're in shock for a good while.
I think that's why, you know, as I said, I'm just not sleeping brilliantly at the moment. My mind's a little bit more active but I think everything is just sort of dawning on me now as to where we are and what we're after going through. And But equally, it's all positive at the moment, so we have to be thankful for that.
Absolutely. Maybe when you're in the middle of the fight, you don't have time to reflect the way you will over the next 6 months.
Exactly. I think that's a lot of it, because there's so much going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's from the treatment to the surgeries to back to treatment, and you know. But now when you hope that's it complete. I think it's only really sort of hit me now.
Yeah. You know, the way you're talking about how fit you were and you had the blood pressure of a 19-year-old, did anyone say to you, gee, starving yourself for most of your adult life wasn't good for you? And has that come up?
I asked the surgeon and I asked the doctors, you know, because obviously that was in my mind, you know, it has the lifestyle of, you know, keeping yourself a stone under your natural weight. And you know, it's a tough regime to keep that off. But they couldn't connect it to each other, you know. So so the answer is no.
Good.
You know, so that is. But that said, you know, the more with the year out and thinking about it, you know, it's something that needs to be addressed as well, in my opinion. Is like, because the next generation, you can see my own kids, they're bigger and they're, you know, and you, I see kids there now trying to make weight, and you know, I think it's time that the weights need to be looked at and addressed and risen to try and make it a bit easier for people.
I mean, it's probably just us, and it's a sure sign we're getting old, but I genuinely think there's been a big jump in the next generation. I think they're taller. There's a serious jump, I think.
No question. I've seen it over the last 10 years in the weigh room. Like, every kid that's come in is getting big. When I started, I was big. Now they're towering over me, you know what I mean, for a flat jockey.
What's a flat jockey weighing in at these days? 9 stone?
You have to be able to ride at 9 stone. If you can't ride at 9 stone, you wouldn't hold down a good job. You wouldn't, you know, you have to be able to. But like, there's, you know, there's good races that have to be ridden at. And on occasion, I did 8.5 stone. Like, so like, to make 8.5 stone, you have to be 8 stone 5. Stripped, you know, so. And like, as I said, you know, people make the comparison with boxers, but boxers only do it for five fights in a year, four fights in a year, yeah, whatever it is.
Less even
for some of them. So, and they've got a whole training camp to get down to that weight. Mm. Whereas we have to do it on a daily basis, you know. People actually don't realise how difficult it is.
I remember reading Kieran Fallon's book. He was in a couple of months ago, and he was, you know, it was almost a funny passage in the book, but actually it wasn't really that funny when you think about it. And he was saying, you know, you'd go out for dinner, and then in the parking lot, we're all out the back puking our guts up.
Yeah, look, some people went down that road, and that's not good. I mean, that's not good. So, and they're the things that we need to prevent these kids from doing. And I think it is a big problem. They call it flipping, and I think it's a big problem with a lot of this generation now, from what I gather. But I don't know. I wouldn't
be surprised, because what alternative would they have bar eat nothing?
Exactly. And, you know, when you're young and the temptations of all the nice food, and, you know, you don't have probably the same discipline as you would when you're, when I was at my, you know, my at our age, you know, so... and I went through a very tough time when I was younger, because obviously your body's changing and you're growing, and I understand exactly how difficult it is for them. But like Adrian McGoldrick, as we spoke about earlier, has done extensive work on trying to, and studies on all of us to try and it's not good reading. You know, how unhealthy it is for us. And
as in, like, the lack of nutrients.
Yeah,
getting?
And like, the, you know, bone density and.
Okay.
You know, so it's something that needs to be addressed, in my opinion.
And like, could a flat jockey, I mean, so say, I don't know loads about racing, I wouldn't pretend to. So say, could they suddenly say, do you know what, we need to make this thing 10 stone, 10 and a half stone. Would it damage the sport?
No, in my opinion, there's nothing will happen other than the times of races will slow down a little bit.
Yeah, but the racing will still be good because it's an equal playing
field. Of course it will.
Yeah.
These horses are ridden out by excellent riders every morning, and they're carrying maybe 11 and a half, 12 stone.
Mm.
With all the exercise saddles and stuff, so it's a poor excuse now, or argument to put up about you know, damaging the horses. That's I just can't accept that one.
Right, okay. Because I do remember Joseph O'Brien, when he was still riding, been in on the show, and he just turned around and said, "Oh, I'll be retiring soon." I thought, that's not right.
Yeah, no, and like, there you go, one of the best riders we've seen. For a long, long time, and his career was cut short because, by God, he's making another career for himself, though.
I'm not that worried about Joseph just yet. Yeah, he's all right. It was interesting what you said to round things off about selfishness.
Yeah.
You know, we talk to different categories of sports people on the show all the time, and there can be the Simon Zeebo, Jamie Heaslip types who barely watch the sport and are relaxed and rock up on game day and do their thing and can park it. I think you're more in the Roy Keane, obsessive, driven, 24/7, am I good enough, self-critical, you're on that stress wheel.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I was, yeah.
What's it like been getting off that? I appreciate in the midst of a difficult time, but has it been interesting to, for the first time probably in your adult life, come away from that hamster wheel?
I've actually, dealt with it well, better than Francis thought I would.
Right.
My family and friends, I think they thought, because I wasn't going to be able to ride, that this could be not good for me. You know what I mean? That how I'm going to cope with it. But I've surprised myself as well in that. But when you're faced with something as serious as what I had to face, I think reality comes into play, and then you realise how important what you're facing is rather than what you have been doing for the last 25 years. But that said, that was me, and that's how I'd like to think that's why I was successful, was because I gave it everything. And when there was obviously, you know, better riders than me, I think my work ethic, my dedication and my determination to succeed overcame the lack of maybe ability in places. And I think that was very, very important for me to make it a success. And thankfully, I think it has been.
Did you enjoy the struggle, the mental struggle, in a grim kind of way?
No. Okay. No, I didn't enjoy it. It's only now I realise that I should have. I'd love to have the attitude of to enjoy the big days and enjoy what I've had for the last 20 odd years. But there's no point in me sitting here telling you a lie, because whatever I did was only good enough, and like, it was all about tomorrow.
Right.
And you know, that is something that's a regret. There's no two ways about it. I'd love to have enjoyed it a bit more.
And do you think you could have and been successful? I know you said you were.
I'm sure I could have. Yeah. You know, those sports people that can have that balance, they're very lucky. You know, they're very lucky. But look, that was me. I can't change who I was. But I must admit, I'm a different person than what I was.
Really?
For the last 25 years, yeah.
Interesting. And if you ever went back and worked in the sport at any level, do you think you would take that newfound perspective with you, or would you very quickly revert to...
No, I'd bring that with me, because, you know, I've realised now, and I will, you know, a decision has to be made very soon about my returning riding, because obviously I work for a big outfit, and no one has put pressure on me, but obviously everyone has to move on. And I'll have to make that decision very soon. And whatever it is, you know, it's going to be tough to get back race riding. I think there's no point in calling myself. But it's not and as I said, that decision will be made very soon. But I want to work within the industry. I know nothing else other than horses. But it's very important that I work in something that gives me satisfaction and that gives me... You know, I still want to have a good way of life and no stress, because, you know, I think stress is as they say, it's a killer.
100%.
And I think there was a great deal of stress throughout the last 25 years as well. And whether I take it or not, but my wife was adamant that was a huge contributor.
Has she seen a change in you from a stress point of view?
I'd like to think so, yeah. I think I'm a different person, as I said. I see life in a whole different... You know, like, I remember Ruby Walsh coming to see me in hospital, and we were talking about would I get back riding, and, you know, and I said, look at all the comebacks you've made. And I said, but then he stopped me and he said, well, I never faced death in the face. When you look at it like that, I think it just sums it up.
Some straight talking from Ruby Walsh. Never.
As always.
As always, yeah. Because I don't know, like, would it be a scary thing to have to get back to making weight again? And because I'd say you're probably... I heard you say you're eating pretty well now.
Yeah.
More than pretty well, exceptionally well.
Oh yeah, and you know, like, I'm a stone heavier now. I'm close to 9.5 stone, which, as I said, you'd be down around 9, 8.5.
I'll be honest, I wouldn't like to take a stone off you looking at you now.
No, well, there you go. So yeah, look, all that has to be taken into account, as I said, but what the one thing I'm not prepared to do is stop riding horses. I want to get back exercising horses in the mornings anyway, and see what happens from there. As I said, I'm not prepared to stop riding horses. I still want to, and I enjoy riding horses, and I want to get back to that.
God, that's a sure sign that you've done something you've loved in your life, that you're itching to even get out in the morning, sunshine, and hop on a horse.
There's nothing better on a good summer's day now, whether I'll be that active through the winter now, I don't know.
And has it been nice eating well in the last year?
Yeah, you know, it's new. Something, and I've enjoyed it. On occasions, my appetite wasn't brilliant for various different reasons, but on the whole, it's been a novelty, but it's helped me as well get through, you know, through everything that I've had to get through, because, you know, throughout the first bout of chemotherapy, the nurses were very keen, you know, to keep weight on, And I don't think they've had someone gain weight while they were on chemotherapy, and that's what I was doing.
God, that just shows you, doesn't it? Because I
Yeah.
heard you say on the Final Furlong podcast, I think, that you're having lots of beetroot because it's good for the pancreas and
Yeah.
all the different nutrients. You're
Yeah, no,
on top of this.
I'm pretty sick of beetroot, but I still take it. And so look, realistically, I'm trying to give myself every chance. That's what I'm doing, Joe, to be honest with you. Trying to have a good diet, trying to eat all the right things, and as cleanly as possible to give myself every opportunity. And as I said, that was in my mind from the start as well, because if it didn't go well, well then at least I've given it every opportunity and given it every shot. And so as I said, thankfully it's gone the right way so far.
Yeah, you owe it to yourself and everyone around you, I suppose. Jeez, I guess to conclude, good on Dee the nurse, and then the journey from there, you've met it head on, which is great.
Yeah, no, look, as I said, I was very fortunate in that I got the right people around me, and thankfully I have that at home. I have great friends, and the most important thing, I had the right medical people, and that was the big deciding factor, I think. And as I said, they've done an amazing job to get me this far, and hopefully it'll continue.
Hopefully so. One day at a time and enjoy life.
Very much so. That's the way we're going to take it. And as I said, yeah, that's very much the plan, is take it every day, one day at a time, and hopefully there'll be plenty of days ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. Pat, I know lots of people will be wishing you well. Thanks for letting us into your home and for giving us your time.
Not at
It's
all.
much
It's an
appreciated.
absolute pleasure. And as I said, hopefully it'll be helpful to some people that are going through the same thing or at the moment. And as I said, if there's one thing, is to try and get the best medical people around you. I know that's repeating myself, but to stay positive, I think, is the most important thing.
Yeah, I'm sure you've had people write to you and reach out to you, have you?
Yeah, and I've had a lot of people call, and people that have been through the same and come out the other side,
Great.
which was obviously very, very important, and give you great encouragement to keep going.
It's better than
But
Google.
yeah, very much so. Yeah, and but as I said, I'm quite open about it, and I have been from more go. And as I said, I'm quite happy to talk about it, and I think that's very helpful, because I don't think bottling up something like this is good for you. And
Did you have an instinct when you were first diagnosed to keep it a secret?
no,
Okay.
I because and we myself and Francis decided immediately that we have to get it out there, because like, three kids here, and you're going to say something on the phone, or you're going to and no, we just said get it out there. There's nothing to be ashamed about. I mean, it's something that, unfortunately, as I said, it has landed on many people's doors, and it unfortunately came to ours. And but as I said, it's nothing to be ashamed about. And and I said, by getting out there and give, telling my story, hopefully it'll help other people. And I think that's important to me.
I'm sure it will. Pat Smullen, thanks so much.
Not at all, Joe. Pleasure.
Off the ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.